Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Peter Jones and I'm the chair for this session, which is titled Current Issues, Super Benefit Projections, Web Calculators and Fee Disclosure. And it's being presented to you by members of the Institute of Actuaries Benefits Projections Working Group. The Benefit Projections Working Group is a subcommittee of the Superannuation and Employee Benefits Practice Committee, whose goal is to, one, position the actuarial profession to be thought leaders in disclosure and advice issues, especially relating to benefit projections, web calculators, and disclosure of fees and costs for superannuation, and secondly, to provide support for actuaries practicing in this area via guidance, etc. The group consists of actuaries who either practice in this area or who have a strong interest in the area. The group comprises six members, three of whom will be presenting to you today. The six members are Andrew McRae, Bill Butler, Colin Grenfell, Darren Wickham, Glenn Langdon, and Ray Stevens. The Benefit Projections Working Group has been responsible for the product and subsequent revision of the practice guidelines for benefit illustrations and has written papers and liaised with regulators on the topic of benefit projections and web calculators and fees and costs. Your three presenters at this session are Darren Wickham, Glenn Langdon and Andrew McRae.
Thank you, Peter, for that introduction, and thank you all for coming to the Benefit Projections Working Group Current Issues session today. Now, I should say that this session is closed to the media today. There are some current issues that are being discussed, and while they're not entirely confidential, they're also not entirely on the public record as well. So we've erred on the side of caution, so any media, please put your pens away. Now, in the next little while, Glenn, Andrew and myself will be covering the latest developments in relation to benefit projections, web calculators and fees and costs. And we're very, very keen to have questions and comments and discussion. So at the end of each of our little speeches, please stand up and say something or throw tomatoes or do whatever you must do. Now, you might think that it's a little bit odd for a benefit projections working group to be interested in fees and costs. And initially I thought it was a bit odd too, but the more you think about benefit projections, the more it's inextricably intertwined with fees and costs. And you only have to look at the industry funds Compare the Pair campaign when they're comparing the impact on benefit projections of different fee structures. And when you talk about and liaise with regulators about prescribing assumptions for benefit projections, you inevitably get drawn into the issue of, is the investment return net or gross of fees and how you do that. So we've been very interested in the fees and costs issue. So today we'll be discussing those three things. But to kick off, it's worth recalling a little bit of history in relation to this issue, because it really does explain where we're heading today and what we're talking about. And if I can take you back to the olden days of benefit projections, the 1980s, the Wild West times of benefit projections, when life insurance agents were doing projections based on ongoing assumptions of 18 and 19%, there was a lot of mis-selling, and it's amazing that there was no class actions or major liability to come out of that. But what did arise out of that was the Insurance and Superannuation Commission issuing circulars which specified assumptions for projections. So that was our first real stab at regulating benefit projections. But those circulars only applied to to life insurance companies and agents. They didn't necessarily apply to super funds. Now, these circulars were withdrawn with the implementation of FSR and the introduction of ASIC licensing in 2003-2004. And at the time of the introduction of FSR, it was generally agreed that benefit projections constitute personal financial product advice. And the implication of that is that you need a statement of advice and you need to have a reasonable basis of advice to provide your projection. And a question mark arose over web calculators. Are they advice? The consensus was that they were. And at the time, many calculators were withdrawn. ASIC issued an information memorandum which allowed calculators to proceed based on them not having any personal information in them. And eventually ASIC clarified this with a class order which remains in place today, which gives calculators an exemption from those advice provisions, provided certain minimum requirements are met, and Andrew will talk about that. But so during this time, the benefit projections, the printed benefit projection statements, have remained financial product advice, and they're not, they haven't been exempt from the advice provisions. During this time, the Institute's also produced a guidance note for members on calculators and benefit projections, and we produced a discussion paper to take the debate forward. And in 2008, shortly after our discussion paper, ASIC held a consultation to change the regulation of printed benefit projection statements. And certainly they've now issued a draft regulatory guide, and Glenn will take us through what that all means and how it's going to work. And more recently, Mr. Cooper has suggested that benefit projections be made compulsory as part of the MySuper proposal. So with that history out of the way, I'll hand you over to Glenn to talk more about the ASIC regulations.
Thanks, Darren. We thought when we were deciding what we were going to talk about today, it would probably be appropriate to take you through CP 122, not just because it's, you know, sort of to tell you about that particular consultative paper, but also you can see that it provides some thinking, some of the thinking that ASIC and the government have got in terms of projections and engagement with members. Also, you can see in my suit in Cooper, it refers to this. So even though this is specifically addressed at a particular area, you can see that it actually will give you some idea of where the government is thinking and where ASIC is thinking in terms of this particular area. And it also is important for those people that are actually involved in advising superannuation funds, because it will have implications for communication programs, for administration systems and the like. So as you know, that at the moment, ignoring intra-fund advice, that it's very difficult for superannuation funds to provide personalised projections for individual fund members without having the appropriate FSR requirements. CP 122 is an attempt to actually provide a mechanism whereby superannuation funds can actually provide projections for members with more limited requirements in terms of the FSR requirements. The consultative paper basically talks about two things: the requirements to have relief for projections, but it also talks a little bit about the interpretation of the current requirements for projection for calculators as well. What I'm going to do is just focus on the projection side of things. That the first thing is, as I said, is that this is all about printed statements. So this is the rules that are going to apply if you want to provide printed projections for members. An important thing is that it is voluntary, and that the importance of that will come out as we look at the requirements to that you have to comply with. That if you do comply with these requirements in terms of the assumptions you use and the methodology you use and also the reporting and the disclosure that you provide to members, then you get relief from the requirements of corporations law. Interesting, the consultative paper sort of says these may or may not apply to defined benefit funds, SMFs and ERFs. When the government actuary got involved in the assumptions, basically the government actuary did actually say that there was some relationship or relevance for this for defined benefit funds. And we'll talk about that quickly. later. In terms of the assumptions they use, the important thing is that the thrust of the consultative paper is that the assumptions are going to be prescribed, and therefore they are actually going to be standardised. You're not going to have any option about the actual level of assumptions, level of investment return, the level of inflation, wage inflation, the level of fees. They're all going to be prescribed by regulation, and there'll only be one set of assumptions that you can use, and therefore these assumptions may have, well, and in a lot of cases will not be relevant to the actual circumstances of the individual member. In terms of the disclosure is all going to be, has to be brought back into today's dollars, and it also is a requirement. Not only are you going to be required to state the projected lump sum at retirement, you're going to have to convert that into an equivalent income stream based on certain assumptions about longevity, who it is, that sort of thing. So again, this is all standardised. Some of the important issues that we see is that they specifically don't allow you to include the age pension. So you're not allowed to, in any way, shape or form, in this projection, actually include, well, first of all, you can't actually include the age pension in the projected income that individual will achieve, but also you can't actually, even with the way we interpret, you can't even say what the age pension is. The projection can't even make reference to the age pension. As I said, that basically the assumptions required to use standardised fees, standardised investment returns, standardised insurance charges, which are sort of supposedly average, indicative, but in a lot of cases for a lot of members and a lot of superannuation funds won't actually be relevant to their particular membership. And finally, the way that the consultative paper actually discusses is that you can only provide one projection, that you can't provide sort of, that's what happens if it's 7%, what happens if it's 8%. You can't actually do scenario testing in the projections. You can't provide a number of different final outcomes projections to actually show people what the impact of different interest rates, etc. And in fact, the consultative paper says that you can only use one retirement age. The government actuary, in looking at the assumptions, is actually talking about the possibility at least of using two ages, so we can get some feel of what the impact of retiring early will be. But as you can see, that you can't actually do additional contributions, it's just going to be one number that's produced for everybody. As I've said, is that the assumptions are going to be prescribed and they're going to be determined by the government actuary. The government actuary has provided to the subcommittee an indication of their thinking on these areas, and at this stage it looks like you'll have one interest rate, investment return, that regardless of what the risk return profile of the member is, regardless of what the level of cost deducted from investment fees, there'll be one basis for fees. In terms of longevity, they're proposing that there'll be a standardised table, mortality table, that's actually used. And what that is we're still a matter of discussing that, but again, it'll be a prescribed basis. And what the government actuary has also done is it has said that the approach that they want to use is a sort of a commutation factor, rather than our preferred approach, which is an iterative process whereby you just take the account balance and adjust it by all of the outgoings and investment earnings and expenses and roll it up as an iterative process. Basically, what the government actuary is proposing is that they come up with a set of commutation factors that are age-based, and you take the standardised administration fee and you multiply it by this factor, and whack, you've got the present value of fees to be deducted from the account. So, that's very much the view that they're taking. The subcommittee has some issues with the proposal as it's put forward. The first issue is, and Andrew will explore this a little further next, but it conflicts with the intra-fund advice situation where the fund can actually provide projections using assumptions that are more related to their own circumstances. And therefore, our feeling is, given that it is voluntary, that those funds that have the capacity to have the wherewithal to use the intra-fund advice approach will in fact go that way rather than go with the CP122 approach, where particularly where the actual assumptions that they're using are significantly different to those that are in the fund. And a classic example of this will be obviously the industry funds, where if the administration charges are standardised administration charges are significantly higher than the actual charges that the industry fund is charging, then we can't see that any industry fund is going to be happy to do projections using fees at a level that's higher than actually in the fund. So they'll elect, again, because it's voluntary, they elect not to do that. We have significant problems with the investment returns because of the... as it has no regard to the actual risk return profile of the member and where we see members moving to more conservative approaches closer to retirement, what we're concerned is that the actual projections that are going to come out of this process will in fact overstate the benefits that a member can expect and do exactly the reverse of what the government's trying to do. What they want to do is they want people to actually engage with the superannuation fund and look into it further. If they look at their numbers and take an extreme, if they're invested in cash, but the investment assumptions assume that they're going to earn balanced fund returns, and they look at that and they say that's an adequate retirement income, but we know that they're not going to produce it, sort of actually comes up with the wrong answers. We're concerned that that if you want to engage your members, then you need to be able to give them a feel for what happens if they put extra money into the superannuation fund. If they make an extra $10 a week contributions, what impact will that have on their final benefits? And so we can't actually do that. One of the requirements... an interesting requirement is that the benefit illustration, that the projection actually has to go out with the annual benefit statement of members. There's no flexibility in that at all. So it can be sent out in two pieces of paper. It doesn't actually have to be incorporated in the actual benefit statement itself, but it has to be actually projected. We think that it's really important that some relationship or indication of the impact of the age pension is actually included.
Just to chip in here, we should say that we were very happy with a lot of what ASIC had proposed. They had listened to our earlier consultation and they did indeed adopt many of the things that we suggested, including the prescribed assumptions. We argued for the government actuary to have a role, and we suggested that all the projections be done on a deflated today's dollar basis based on wage inflation. So they did actually listen to us, and we're quite pleased with a lot of it. But what the proposal seems to be, even though it's a voluntary system of projections, it seems that they've built the regulations for a mandatory system. Now, some of you might be familiar with the UK, where they have statutory money purchase illustration. So every member of a DC fund gets this mandatory projection, and there's only one result that's projected. So in that sort of rigid, compulsory situation, you do only want to have one projection. You want the rules to be very rigid. But when the trustee has to pay money themselves to do this, and there's no compulsion for them to do it, they want to have some sort of return on their investment and their effort. And allowing a bit more flexibility to, you know, project extra contributions, to generate that call to action from members to engage them is what we'd expect to see in a voluntary system. But it really does seem that all of the rules have been heading towards a compulsion, and maybe now with Cooper we're heading that way.
And well, and the other thing is that, again, our position is that where there is one assumption, there should be a cap. And so particularly in the investment area, that it's desirable that there is an upper limit on the return, so we don't get the sort of things that Darren talked about, you know, sort of projections at ridiculous rates of return. But trustees should have the ability to actually use lower investment returns if they feel it's appropriate in the circumstances. And just to close off, as I said, that we believe that it is important, particularly for people that lower projected incomes, that some interaction with the age pension is actually desirable. And we just note that John Burnett has actually said that there's an easy way to do this. And I'm not sure how easy that would be in terms of, but clearly there are ways that we can actually engage members in terms of the impact of age pension. It may not exactly represent what the impact is for them, and if they want to find out the exact impact, they need to go and get advice. But they need to know that if they're at certain levels of income, then the impact of the age pension is this, and as that changes, the age pension changes as well, so that they know that, particularly for people on lower incomes, that what's in the superannuation fund and what's coming out of the superannuation fund is not the only source of income they have.
Sorry, if I might just make one more comment there. The age pension is not a financial product. It's not regulated by corporations law. Anyone can give advice on it. So we're quite surprised that ASIC included this provision in the requirements, and we're not quite sure they actually have the jurisdiction under corporations law to prohibit advice on the age pension.
All right. I'll hand it over to Andrew.
CP 122 that Glenn's been talking about, as you mentioned, it is still just in consultation phase, and although they have released sort of draft regulatory guide and whatnot, it's not actually in place yet. So we're still going to be in continued consultation with both the government actuary and ASIC on this until it does come to some sort of fruition. In the meantime, there's still some other ways that benefit projections can still be provided to members, and in particular one which was alluded to before was the intra-fund advice rules. So these are available because of a class order that ASIC issued last year. Now, normally, as Darren pointed out, if funds were to actually issue these benefits, any sort of benefit projections, they would have to issue it with a full statement of advice, and they would have had to do some sort of fact find in order to justify their benefit projection. In the case of large funds particularly, that's just not practical. You can't go out to a fund the size of Australian Super or Rest or any of the other suitably large funds and get all that personal information that you need in order to be able to do a full statement of advice, taking all their personal circumstances into account. So what the intra-fund advice rules actually allow for is for the fund to actually do a projection on what they consider to be sort of a reasonable basis and actually be able to send those out. There are a few things that the fund will still need to consider, though. So they will still need to have a AFSL licence that allows them to give personal advice, otherwise they won't be able to issue the SOA. and the advice actually has to be on a single issue only. So that they can't be making it look like they've taken all of the factors into account when really they're only considering one item in isolation. They can sort of throw insurance that's sort of bundled into the fund as a separate item into this, but generally it's only a single item. In line with it being a statement of advice, SOA, that the member will need to be informed in writing as soon as possible after the advice has been given that it has been issued in accordance with this class order, and that if they're going to be affected by any changes in fees, costs, any other charges they're going to be paid, then they have to be similarly advised about that. But that's just a standard thing with any statement of advice that they could give. As Glenn pointed out, the difference between this and CP122 is that the trustees would be able to use any assumptions they wanted on this basis, whereas under CP122 they have to use the prescribed ones in the consultation paper, or the regulatory guide that'll be issued. Did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, just to make the comment that we've ended up with a two-tier system, and we're not quite sure that was what was originally intended. So we've got this very prescribed approach, and we've got this almost laissez-faire approach. And funds issuing a benefit projection as a statement of advice is not really that onerous. In some ways, it's just a format, and with minimum certain things you include in that format. So we've ended up with these two systems. We're not quite sure that was intended, and our recommendation to ASIC was that that be clarified, because we do think there are good things in having some standardisation and consumer protection with benefit projections, because we don't want to have 19% projections under statements of advice. But, so we've asked for clarification.
Darren's going to be talking about fees and costs later, hopefully not too much later. but here we've got a sort of an extract from the Cooper Review here. Now, obviously, one of the major reasons that trustees do want to provide a projection to their members is so that they can provide answers to questions like, how much money am I going to have at retirement? How much money do I need in retirement? How much am I likely to have if things keep on going as they're going at the moment? Am I going to actually have enough in retirement to maintain the lifestyle that I actually want to live? There's been various studies done into this. I suppose the ASFA Westpac numbers are probably the most common ones that seem to be bandied about at the moment, as to how much money someone might need to actually survive on a day-to-day basis. So a lot of these concepts are sort of things that the consultation paper 122 has been looking to achieve, so it's not too surprising that it has been endorsed in this way in the Cooper Review or the report. This methodology is sort of it's probably Nick Sherry's preferred approach to policy, and that may be another reason that it's sort of been endorsed in this way. Another question that I suppose CP122 explicitly denies us being able to pursue, though, is not only is how much money do I need, how much money will I have, it's if I'm not going to have enough, what can I actually do about it? And we think that's an important question that could be answered with benefit projections, but it at the moment isn't proposed to be allowed in this format. So to a certain extent, the what can I do about it question is something that can be answered in the form of web calculators. Now, there's obviously a lot of funds or other financial institutions out there that are putting benefit projections on their websites in the form of web calculators. These, as Darren pointed out, are issued in accordance with the ASIC class order, but that was actually in 2005 that's been issued, so they haven't actually provided any updates or anything to that since. So what this basically allows the fund to do is to provide these calculators, which would generally be considered advice, but they won't be deemed to be providing advice so long as the certain rules are followed. So essentially what that means is that for any of the assumptions that you make to put in that calculator, the member has to be able to change it to a different assumption and rerun the simulation. So things like investment return, inflation rates, etc., they have to be able to change it and run it in a situation that's more suitable to them. That doesn't apply to things like tax rates or income thresholds or anything like that that's more statutory defined, but anything that's been come up with, like the investment return or not, has to be editable. So in terms of default assumptions that go in the calculator, the class order says that they must be reasonable for the purpose of working out the estimate. So any sort of reasonable, depending on how you define it, can be used in the calculator. I might pass over to Darren, unless you want to make any comments about this one at the moment. Or you can make them up here.
Just to make just an observation on that. So if the government actually prescribes assumptions for benefit projections, then they can apply to calculators. Calculators can satisfy the requirements to be reasonable based on that. But before I go on to the fees and costs, there's probably a good opportunity to sort of throw it open to questions, comments and views on benefit projections, what ASIC's being proposed, what were our comments. Over to you.
You just state your name and just confine your question to a couple of minutes or comments.
Thanks, John. Anthony Asher. And just to add something in terms of history, my understanding is that in the mid-80s there were voluntary codes of conduct on illustrations. Certainly there were in South Africa and the UK, and I think here. And taken over by the ISC, got worse, neglected, and eventually culminated in what I think one has to describe as the grotesque FSR of 2003. Now, I say that, and I don't want to be provocative on this score, but the fact of the matter is that there seems to be we are cursed by a regulator that doesn't understand the issues. And attempting to collaborate with in that environment doesn't necessarily produce the right results, as you've shown. Has the committee stood back and said, do we want to collaborate, or do we want to say it should all go and we should start again? Because, frankly, we might well be much better off if they just took the FSR away.
I guess we've just assumed that FSR is here to stay and the advice provisions are here. And I mean, we have taken a step back and we thought, well, what's being proposed is restrictive and it's not ideal. But on the other hand, we sort of weighed that up against, at the moment, members don't have information. But you ask a member what they're likely to get in retirement, they have no idea. No, they'll be out 50, 100, 300%. So in some ways it's the lesser of two evils. An imperfect projection's better than none, because there needs to be some setting of more realistic expectations in the community, because there is none. So I guess it's a lesser of two evils approach. I mean, we're still liaising, and we're lesser of two evils.
I think the important thing in this context is that the thing that's coming through CP122 Cooper is that the word engagement. So that what I see is happening is that FSR, you're right, is basically a nightmare in terms of what you've got to do to actually provide advice. And so what ASIC, and you know, let's say ASIC stroke the government, are trying to do is actually get around the requirements of FSR, right, but engage members. So if you look at CP122, the first thing that they say is they want to engage members. Right, then what they, and if you look at Cooper, it says we want to engage members. And so that the primary objective that I see of retirement projections is not necessarily to tell members, in fact, it isn't to tell members, you know, this is what you're going to get on retirement. What it is all about giving the members something that will frighten the buggery out of most members and make them go and get some advice. So so I see that, you know, this, where this is going is a reflection of what you're actually saying, is that for 90% of members of superannuation funds, sort of they won't go and get advice. So how do we actually give them something that will make them think that they should actually go and talk to somebody?
Angie Mastropoleto, isn't it a problem with little knowledge is a dangerous thing with this? Is that there probably needs to be a whole education campaign around interpreting the numbers for members, and that the numbers themselves can actually be misleading?
Well, that's right. And it's up to trustees, if it's a voluntary system, to, if they're giving this advice, to help communicate it. And if you're a trustee and you're going to spend the money to do this on a voluntary basis, you want to get bang for your buck. You want people to understand it and take action to make extra contributions. So if it's voluntary, then the trustee has an interest in wrapping that advice, that communication and education with it. If it's mandatory, then the whole thing's completely different. This is a government-initiated thing. It'd be a standard format. Just like in the UK, there'd be a sort of a broader educational campaign around that. I mean, the reality is, with whatever you post to members, 50% is going to get thrown in the bin, and the other 50% will look at it. And that's not ideal, but at the moment, a web calculator is very good, but only a small portion of people use them. And when they use them, they like them, and they use them a lot. But in some ways, this is pushing information to members. And we've said printed statements. We didn't envisage that it would have to be printed. You could do it on the web or you could do it on the email. It's more pushing the information to the member rather than going to a calculator and initiating the calculation themselves.
Can I just say that, yeah, in fact, we've recognised that issue, and the position that we've been taking, the concern that we've got is the one I've said, is that once you have standardised assumptions, that in a meaningful number of cases, the actual results that will come out of that will have no relevance to the actual circumstances, the expected benefit of the individual. And what we're worried about is, you know, in fact, some of the assumptions that the government actually is actually proposing for some funds will significantly overstate the final benefit. Right, so the position that the committee's been taking is that we believe engagement's correct. You know, we think something is better than nothing. That an indication of what a member is going to get on retirement is desirable, but that the assumptions that are used should be, you know, sort of comparable to what is reasonable for that member. And thirdly, that those projections should actually give trustees an ability to provide members simply with an indication of the impact of making some changes.
Okay, were there any other questions or comments?
Can I make a quick comment? This is partly based around the UK experience, but one feature of these benefit statements is that people often read them as if they're promises, and of course one thing we know about these, whilst they're reasonable projections, they won't be in line with the final outturns in terms of investment returns and longevity and all the rest of it. So there can be substantial variations from year to year or 1 5-year period to the next on what an individual will get, even if the underlying assumptions themselves are unchanged simply because the underlying fund values may be fluctuating substantially. So that I think that's been a real issue, that you had this move to statutory money purchase onto a real basis, which was a step forward. But I don't think the nature of the risk has emerged until people have begun to compare statement from one year to the next. Mm. Now, we are seeing a move towards incorporating stochastic information and stochastic projection into these sorts of projections by benefit providers, but it's a beginning of what will be quite a long process, I think, of educating and communicating risk.
Yes, the UK statutory money purchase illustration rules, the TM1, the technical memorandum, is currently up for consultation, and those stochastic issues are being raised. And certainly we'd support having more flexibility to illustrate risk and the impact of it.
Yeah, the problem that you've got is that people that are engaged, right, will go and get advice, and they will be willing to spend money and time actually understanding sort of variability and all of these different things. So as Darren said that basically people that use calculators use them a lot. So it's the problem is how do you get, but that's only, I don't know what the number is, but let's say it's 10% of people or 5% of people are actually engaged in their superannuation. The issue is how do you actually get a 35-year-old whose retirement benefits are going to be inadequate if they don't start doing something now to actually start to look at it. And that's, I think that's the government, my personal view is I'm very supportive of the idea is that we have to get members interested in their superannuation earlier. It's no point in trying to start this at 55 because it's too late. You need them to be thinking about this at 35. Most 35-year-olds are not interested, don't want to spend the time, not going to do it. Some form of projection that suddenly says that you're going to get 5 cents in retirement, it's going to be wrong, and you know it's going to be wrong, but if it makes them think about superannuation, then it's achieved its objectives.
Look, I'm going to leave the discussion there for the benefit projections and move quickly on to fees and costs, and hopefully we'll have time for more discussion at the end. So there's three sort of current areas of interest for this disclosure of fees and costs. The first is the short-form PDS regulations. The second is RIPOL, and the third is Cooper. And I think throughout this conference, RIPOL, Cooper and Henry are a bit of a theme. But first to the PDS. The short-form PDS was a response to Nick Sherry's Bernie pub test, where you should have a PDS which is understood by the people in the Bernie pub, his local watering hole. And the idea is to simplify it and cut out a lot of the garbage. One feature of the proposed regulations for PDSs is a projection of fees and costs over a 10-year period. And that projection of fees and costs is shown as a percentage of the account balance on average, and both admin and investment fees are projected. Now, both the Institute and ASFA, during the consultation, expressed concerns about this approach and the potential for it to be misleading, particularly for members with perhaps lower or higher balances. It can actually give quite an incorrect result using that sort of level percentage of assets type approach. So the Institute suggested two things. First of all, to do different scenarios as well as the standard one. But secondly, to project admin fees only and leave investment fees to be netted out of the investment return. So your investment performance is a net of investment fee performance. And that would simplify disclosure on investments and make investment returns more comparable. But it also would avoid the high investment fees swamping the impact of administration costs. So that consultation was in February this year. I haven't heard the outcome of that. I suspect it's been on hold for the Cooper recommendations. So the second big area is RIPOL, and for my next two slides, I'm confining my comments to Ripoll and Cooper just to the fees and cost disclosure issues, not the broader issues. There's a lot to talk about. So in relation to fees and costs, Ripoll and the government response to Ripoll have said that FSGs should be strengthened, that there should be dollar disclosure within the FSGs of advisor remuneration, and that advisor fees can be paid out directly by the member or out of the member's account, and commissions are banned. And the key distinction between commissions and an advisor fee paid out of a member's account is that the advisor sets the fee, not the product provider. And that's an important distinction, and it's quite interesting because what the implication of that is, if you have to charge an advisor fee direct to a member's account and not bundle it as part of the admin or investment fee, then suddenly retail fees for superannuation products will drop, and reasonably substantially. Well, they're not going to be wholesale, but you'd hope they'd hop. Anthony might disagree. But so that's an interesting dynamic. There's consultation to take place, and I'm interested in Anthony's views on that. And finally, Cooper. The Institute argued to Cooper in its submission that we should split admin and investment fees and disclose them separately, and that there'd be a standard naming convention for fees and costs. And once again, we supported a projection regime for fees, but on different scenario basis. We also recommended separate disclosure of advice fees. So a few weeks ago, Mr. Cooper presented his report on MySuper, and as we've all heard, it's a simple default arrangement, and in order to be a default fund under choice of fund with SG or a default fund under a modern award, you have to be MySuper compliant. And in relation to fees and costs, that means a few things. And the first is that there's no cross-subsidisation between different groups of members. So a personal division can't be subsidising the accumulation division in a master trust, for example. There has to be a formal policy on cost allocation, and breaches of this policy would be reportable to APRA. There'd have to be separate accounting for MySuper and other divisions of a fund, including audited financial statements. There'd be no contribution fees or exit fees would be based on cost recovery. Buy-sell fees would be linked to actual transaction costs. Fee schedules would be explicit and not subject to negotiation, the discounts. I'm not quite sure what that means. Performance fees have to meet a standard, and trustees have to participate in a benchmarking exercise for fees. They're compelled to do that. And there's no trailing commission that would be paid, and advice fees would be deducted explicitly out of a member's account. So that's consistent with what Ripoll has said. But these are proposals. There's no legislation yet. I guess we'll have to wait and see. So are there any questions or comments about fees? Come on, Andy.
Anthony Asher. Sorry, you did ask that, Eric. three or four at least situations where I've seen a move towards a greater freer market in advice commission type selling fees. In each case, it's been expected that the additional disclosure and the fiduciary responsibilities of agents, brokers, financial advisors would lead to reduction. This is in the UK, here, South Africa. In each occasion, fees have gone up, sometimes quite significantly.
The advisor fees or the product fees?
Advisor fees, okay. The actual commissions. I mean, okay. I think on my calculation, front-ended commissions actually were cheaper than back-ended trail commissions, but I'd be interested to see if you agree with that.
Yeah.
But, sorry, I just say, the only place where marketing costs have come down, Chile, I think, is a recent example. Mm. You just put a ceiling on it. And I suspect that we're going to end back there to say, you may not charge more than X.
Mm. Yeah, I don't have a view as to whether or not advisor costs would go up. I guess what I was saying was that the advisor costs were wrapped up in the fee structure for super products in admin fees. And if you strip that out, then you'd expect there to be some fall in the admin fees.
Yeah, can I say that? I mean, I think that the big difference will be that the problem with commission is that everybody is charged the same level of commission. So, I mean, in terms of the percentages. So basically, if one of their clients has lots of advice and another client has very little advice, there's a fundamentally a cross-subsidisation between all of the client base. What I expect that will happen with fee-based advice is that you'll find that the people with the $500,000 accounts and $1 million accounts will suddenly be paying, you know, substantially more for their advice. You know, so what it'll be related to the actual advice that they get. Yeah, and the other point about it is that the financial advisors will be more directly responsible for justifying the fees that they're charging. So that I think that although fees may go up in certain circumstances, because of, you know, they're going to have to actually provide stuff and services to justify those fees, because they're going to be clearly someone's going to have to sign a piece of paper saying pay these fees. Whereas, as you know, commission, the problem with commission, particularly trail, is no one really knows. None of the clients know that they're paying trail fees. Really, I mean, it just comes out of the account or out of the investment return.
Any other questions, particularly about benefit projections, calculators, or?
Darren, mate, could you just comment on why they're rejecting the inclusion of the age pension?
We asked that question. The consultation paper itself says that it's too complex. Now, we suggested we've got a way to do it, and John's obviously thinking along the same lines. You can do it. It's going to be wrong. But all projections are ultimately going to be wrong. And in our view, it was actually misleading to take the age pension out, because you've got things like the marginal tax rates embedded in the means test. So to take out the age pension, and for most people, the age pension is going to be the majority of their income. So we tried to argue that case. We also tried to argue that ASIC's own calculators include the age pension. And they acknowledge that point.
Yeah, can I say, I think one of the problems that CP122 has is that there's this real conflict that basically what the consultative paper says is that these should be a reasonable estimate of the benefits that people are expected to get. So they actually say we want this to be a good estimate of what you're going to get. And then they say we're going to set a whole series of assumptions that don't necessarily have any regard to your own personal circumstances. And I sort of see the age pension being a little bit like that. You know, so on one hand, we'd really like to give you a really good estimate of what you're going to get, and because of the complexities of age pensions, we really can't give that with any confidence that it's right. But we're happy to do approximations everywhere else, but we're not happy to do an approximation on the age pension. There's a real conflict in what they're trying to achieve, and I'm not sure. I must say, this is my personal view. I'm not sure that they really understood the outcomes of what they were doing.
Okay, gentlemen, you've given us a tremendous insight into the good work that the Benefits Projection Working Group is doing on behalf of the Institute. It does have long-term ramifications for all Australians. And on behalf of the Institute and everyone in the room, thank you very much for your presentation.